people. So thank you, everyone. I was sort of, I can't tell who's in the Zendo. I've recognized half your blurry little shapes, but I guess we'll find out later who was there. So, and I've got lots of Zoom and happy Thanksgiving weekend for those that celebrate. And so we're going to carry on with our Bodhisattva precepts. And this week, we're going to talk about the second spoke of the wheel. But just for those who may not have been around, we're working on the six perfections of the Bodhisattva path. And the image we've been using and I like is the wheel and the various spokes of the wheel that help our practice. Last week, we talked about generosity. And this is the precursor to all of the paramitas or the gateways. And one of the ways of looking at it was a way of softening up our attitudes and preparing us for the warm heart of compassion of the Bodhisattva. And so we explored, you know, the gift of generosity and how we do that and how we discern, and went down the trail of fearlessness, and maybe that might be one of the companion attitudes that we need to have. And certainly offering generosity to all beings, but especially to ourselves. And that that might be one of the more difficult positions. So I'm looking at, like I said, I kind of keep looking at this. So we've put in the first spoke. And now I think we're going to the other side of the wheel to put in the second spoke, which is the perfection of morality. I should also mention to you too, I'm doing something a little bit different, so I'm not sure it'll translate. Apparently shuffling papers is not always interpreted as leaves shuffling in the forest or whatever, so I am trying to read off of my computer, so hopefully that'll go, but it's different, you know, the paper is different than computers, so we'll see. So the second parameter perfection is the perfection of morality or ethical conduct or skillful action, depending on whose book you read and which perspective you take. But they generally don't have too many variations on this one, is that it's, you know, looking at good conduct and how to lead your life. And the general purpose of these being added in is originally came about as rules to govern communities of monks and nuns, and was intended to support their practice. And then later they've been broadened out beyond the monastic realm and become part of the lay practice. And as those of you who've studied the precepts and taken Jukai or certainly Synergy, you've certainly seen that, or perhaps visited a retreat center that actually asked you to observe the precepts while you were there. So it might not be something you do in your formal practice day to day, but they ask you when you're doing that at their center. So the precepts are actually just conducts of behavior, general rule intended to regulate thought or actions. And certainly we also know from the writings that the Buddhists distinguish between rules that are moral in a primary sense as they affect the treatment of others and rules that protect the practitioner's own commitment to training. So they're not just training paths, but they're not just to prohibit immoral behavior, but they're more importantly, they've been designed to transform the character of the practitioner. As Reb Anderson kind of states in his book, Bodhisattva precepts are Bodhi nature precepts. That is to say, they're Buddha making precepts. So just to kind of get it into context. And again, for a lot of you, this will be pretty familiar, but it might not be for some of you. So in our practice, we have 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and they're clumped into three categories. So I'm just going to look at the kind of broad brush about those categories. And the detail will leave for your Jukai study groups and things like that, or for whatever you do at another, but we won't go, we're certainly not going to go into each one of them one by one. So for the first part, the refuges that we would chant is, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. As per Norman, they're not really precepts, strictly speaking, because they don't really describe what to do or not to do. But what they are, what it's designed to do is to confirm one's primary motivation and basic commitment to universal goodness and benefit of all. And they point to the human confidence in human goodness and the bodhisattvas feel, and underlies their practice of ethical conduct in the Triple Treasure. So other writers, like Diane Risotto, look at these as the refuges to practice virtuous or wise actions begins with what we return to, no matter what life brings our way, joy, happiness, sadness, sorrow, sickness. And so the refuges are, in a way, literally, as they're classically defined, security and sanctuary. But they're not just a safe haven, they're a place of strength and energy. And they're a place to return to our true nature as awakened beings who, without exception, possess open hearts and minds. We may feel that we don't have that, but that's only because we've forgotten what's true. And so with each part, taking refuge in Buddha is the deepest wisdom and compassion within each of us. Understanding and living the teachings, the Dharma, and the community of all beings and our interconnection with everything, not just this planet, but all the billions of galaxies, and that's our Sangha. So we rely on our original nature, which is pure and fully endowed with wisdom and virtues of all Buddhas. So the next second clump are what are referred to as the pure precepts. And these are kind of, I think I've used the word broad brush already, but kind of a broad brush representing the three-step process of the practice of ethical conduct. They're reminders of how we want to live our lives. And they've also been designed to demonstrate increasingly significant categories. This is according to Wright. The categories are restraint, virtue, and altruism. So the first one, I vow to refrain from harmful conduct, is the restraint, noticing and checking conscious and unconscious selfishness, which is counterproductive to real self-love and love of others. Pure precepts, avoid all action in body, speech, and mind that creates suffering. And observes with great care and exactitude with no thought of reward. The second one, I vow to cultivate beneficial conduct. It's the development of virtue. Cultivating positive inner qualities matches by outer conduct that go beyond mere restraint to encouraging and increasing an inner passion for goodness and caring. We take action that creates true happiness. This is a vow of awareness, what we can do specifically. And the third, I vow to benefit all beings, so the altruistic arm. The full bodhisattva joy in benefiting others, loving and helping without a sense of restraint or a need to develop virtue, takes actions that includes others in our hearts and our minds, and vow to keep in mind that our and others' happiness are connected, that when we reach out to help others, we help ourselves. And that's manifested in full bodhisattva joy. Shows the bodhisattva's overarching concern for the welfare and enlightenment of others. And in the final analysis, moral action is not individual, but collective, and the bodhisattva engages in morality for the betterment and enlightenment of all. Then we get into the third chunk. And again, depending on who you read or which Zendo you practice in, they'll either be referred to as the grave or the clear mind precepts. And these are a little more specific, a little more fine brushed, a little more detail. And they're the more detailed version of the first two pure precepts. And they're designed to sketch out the kind of conduct we want to restrain and the kind we want to promote. Now, I don't know. And I look at these, I'm sort of like, this is the belly of the beast precepts, you know. So I did look and I had to talk about Wright. He talks about some of the more, you know, the original lists of precepts. And classically, the first five are pretty universal and not unique to Buddhism and apply to all. So not harming, not stealing, inappropriate sexual activity, false speaks, intoxicants, and that's everybody. One set that he listed here were for the monks and nuns, not eating after midday, not attending entertainment, not wearing jewelry or perfume, not sleeping on luxurious beds, not handling money. And I think, you know, some people have heard that on some, depending on what sects you've followed. And these are patterns of voluntary training. But they are the all of 10 or whatever way they're put together, is that they're essentially taught as restraints of body, speech, and mind. So I thought that was interesting. Body, killing, stealing, sex, speech, lying, slander, mind, anger, malice, false views. So the precepts that we chant in every full moon are two-sided. So they have, how do I want to put it? A do and a don't, or a don't and a do. So we have practices, you know, not killing, but practices non-harming, does not steal, but lives without greed, does not misuse sexuality, but maintains integrity in personal relationships, does not speak falsely, but is true in word and action, does not get intoxicated or engage in activities that cloud the mind, does not slander others, but uses kind speech, does not praise self and belittle others, but praises others, is not possessive, but is generous, does not harbor ill will, but cultivate kindness, and a disciple of Buddha, always cherishes Buddha, studies Dharma, and nurtures Sangha. And I think that's interesting too, the last one, and Norman talks about this, that's added in there just to kind of bring a full circle back to our commitment to the refuges, committing ourselves to thinking and speaking about the three treasures in a respectful way. That might be, he says, at times you might find you're cynical about the teachings or whatever. And then his is, what you don't polish will tarnish. So I like that. So the purpose of the grave and clear precepts are to help us look deep within ourselves, to find what veils our deepest qualities as human beings. They help to bring down the walls of separation, and they reveal the ways in which we fall into vicious cycles of thinking and acting, causing suffering to ourselves and others. And then most of you have found, Norman says, states being the obvious, they're working with the precepts, what best can be done, but they're tricky. Very, very, oh, I see cats wandering around. So we, oh, and I know I say so much, so please forgive me, I'm trying to break that one. I can only do one thing, paper rustling was today, so maybe next week I'll be sold. The precepts, I think it's important to take a look at what Wright says about the teachings and how the precepts are used and the morality that this paramitas is that warns about grasping to the precepts too firmly and rigidly. And grasping and clinging to precepts was thought to prevent the development of more skillful forms of moral awareness. The attachment to moral rules often undermines compassionate and liberating connection to other people that morality tends to cultivate in society. Whenever rule following becomes mechanical and self-serving, where there's only joyous guardings of one's moral standing, the perfection of morality is rendered impossible. Also cautions, and probably leads to this statement, on the preoccupation about the quality of others' actions leads to being inattentive to one's own. That's a good caution, you know, and I think we all know of that, and we know that even from ourselves. Actually, sometimes often when we're first learning rules and guidances and things like that, we get preoccupied with ours, but we really, I speak for myself, may get preoccupied by how other people are following and whether they're doing or not doing what they're supposed to be doing, quote unquote. So, and the other important consideration that about this paramita is that, and the precepts, that they were never intended to view these actions as moral defects. That's good. So how do they work and how are they supposed to be used? I found something kind of interesting in the reading that got a little bit into the wordsmithing, and the sila or shila paramita is ethical conduct. But then I read Robert Aiken and Diane Rizzotto, and they both define the second paramita as shila, literally meaning cool and peaceful. And I tried to fact check that and I couldn't find it. So I'm not really sure who, you know, I think she got it from him or whatever. And it matters not, because I kind of like the spirit of it. And then maybe somebody will let me know if there is another interpretation in another language. But I really like the notion and the vision of cooling and peaceful when we're thinking of the precepts. And Diane's explanation with that is that it's suggesting that we're taking care with our actions and they're not intended to become an eradication of human tendencies. Rather, they're there to cool or calm. Has a different connotation than to uproot and destroy. Precepts serve as a guidepost that help us recognize where we cause suffering for ourselves and others through carelessness, irresponsibility, and hurtful actions. And I liked her explanation the best of some on how they work and ways to work with them. And she's got a few images here. They serve as a warning light, sometimes like a stoplight to put on the brakes, or a lighthouse that warns of dangerous waters and keeps them on course. They simply remind us to say no before moving on. And I kind of got thinking too, even with the image of that, you know, there's two other lights on that, you know, standard. And there's, and I think they could also, you could look at the green or the yellow light too. Another image is a sign above the door and an invitation to enter and explore. Or a riddle of sorts, engaging them and how to engage them skillfully. Tools of discernment, should or not should. Or keys, unlocking the closets we don't want to unlock, help us turn it inward, but also unlocking our deepest capacity for love, empathy, fairness, and joy. Another approach is to use them as vows of prohibition or aspiration, or vows to express commitment and willingness to persevere. So she talks about the pause, no, the no pause, It's not meant as a rejection or a denial of our intention, but rather a reminder to refrain from what might be habitual reactions and patterns. I also got thinking too that you could also frame this as not the word N-O, but you could also put it as the other no, K-N-O-W, which is a no pause too, which still gets you to maybe ponder. I just thought that's what it brought for me. And that mostly is because of this. Think of the no as creating a space for us to explore alternative action. And we do this by exploring skillful means, recognizing that sometimes this is an ongoing non-linear process, that moral conduct functions as boundaries as we look to do the deep work of studying the self. And we looked and question our intentions to cultivate clarity and awareness. And that ultimately, they're designed to encourage a mental attitude of taking action that is supportive rather than harmful. And then maybe, perhaps after long practice, some clarity arises as to their wisdom. The boundaries of self and others fall away, and our actions flow naturally out of selflessness activity. This is living an ethical or virtuous life. Now, as I ponder the precepts, especially I said those, the grave or clear-minded precepts, I think I'm probably, like most other people, there's some of them I look at and I kind of go, yeah, no problem. And others I go, problem. And the in-between ones, and then depending on the day, problem. But I know for myself, the ones that probably occupy my day the most are the really tricky or difficult ones. And I also can't help looking at them under the lens I've been exposed to and trained under, is that that sort of looks like the seed of our chronic habit and addiction behaviors. Especially that little one-liner about clouding the mind, which has a whole bunch of things that are in there. It's just not substances of any type, but behaviors, video games, and all that kind of stuff. And that most of those things have arisen out of self-soothing. And they may have been there for a very good reason, and persist, but they may not be serving any longer in a constructive way. And it brings light back to our whole notion of twisted karma and our propensity and essential hardwiring for repetitive habit patterns, both positive and not so positive. I'm going to take a little swing back to the idea of karma, the more contemporary view. We certainly know that there's the past one on that's your karma, and it's very merit oriented, and that, you know, and that there's a sense of helplessness around karma. Other suggestions from other better writers than myself. To practice with the precepts is to begin opening a passage through which we can be free of that suffering of habitual, and asks us to explore our root sources of suffering. Karma is action. Actions matter and it's effective. It includes intention and volition, and the quality of your thinking and feeling is important. So not so much like the older understanding where it's fatalistic, caste-oriented, or cosmic focused. The Buddha and his radical innovation was to emphasize the power and crucial importance of personal ethical choice. One simply observes actions and results and adjusts conduct. There's no owner of the action, therefore, not my fault. because it's a result of many factors, amongst which are my own past actions. And then there's the perspective of karma, shaping character and helps determine who or what you become. It also helps shape others and the society in which you live now and into the future. It encourages others to treat you in ways that correspond to your character. They will often do unto others as you have done unto them, although not always. This is all from Wright. And keeping a disassociation between merit and external rewards is important to maintain. Although good acts do lead to the development of good character, being good does not always necessarily lead to a life of good fortune. I think it's just to help dispel a little bit on that merit stuff from way back and people buying their way to heaven or wherever. And I was actually looking through my little books. I was picked up one of my addiction books, and this one's by Brewer. And I just wanted to revisit, you know, cause and effect. And it was really interesting because it's when you look under it, under Buddhist lens, they came up with this little graphic and titled it Dependent Origination. It sounds familiar. And that it begins with a cue or a trigger. Sight, smell, thought, body, mind. And then the mind takes it in as a pleasant or unpleasant sensation, which leads to craving or attachment, aversion, and then a behavior, and then a habit, and then it reinforces itself. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the two hands of the sort of like the teaching karma and then the biological karma, I guess, for lack of another term, that all play into what goes on with our reactions. So a couple other concepts. Anderson. These Buddha nature precepts are not a self-improvement project. They are for self-realization. And in my thinking, I'm not sure if one can take on self-realization without entering into a realm of discomfort or distress. It's got the potential there, and we know it does, right? So, but the shift in the self-improvement versus self-awareness. It's subtle, but it's important. And I really like the part that Norman talks about, and I think is really critical to this precept and the study of the precepts, is that as we look through this, we're going to see mistakes. And we're going to feel bad. And we should, you know, in some ways, there's some that we do feel bad in that, you know, precepts can be used to keep you honest. And we'll probably do it more than once and do it over and over again. And what he cautions about is not about making the leap from regret and jumping to the conclusion that we are inherently bad people doomed to do bad things. It's a deeply held Buddhist perspective that there is no such thing as a fixed person, let alone an inherently bad or inadequate person. There's only what happens, arising and passing moment by moment according to conditions. So it's just tendencies and habits. And we take responsibility for them. And then when we find ourselves indulging in profound self-denigration, remember what is true. We did something to hurt. We regret it. We take responsibility because it's good for us. But there is no blame. Whatever we've done is probably because of conditioning, and we'll probably repeat the lesson many times over. And so then we get into the last part about forgiveness practice that's coupled with this. And again, this is all from Norman. Self-recrimination, blame, shame are compelling. The only thing that heals is love, but it can be blocked. It can be blocked by conditioning of past hurts received and given. Forgiveness practice is basic. The hurt is always there. We need to be forgiven by ourselves, others, and life. Forgiveness clears the heart of resentment and blame, which clutter and make it impossible to hear the gentler tones that inspire practicing kindness. We can't practice forgiveness aggressively. We can practice it by simply being willing to notice the pain and then the blame and the resentment we've added to it, which is, we might admit to ourselves we actually don't want to be forgiven or be forgiven, or that we're addicted to the pain that we're covering up with our hard-heartedness. And so he lists. So you notice the pain, you let yourself feel it, you take a breath and say, yes, this is how it is. And you do this repeatedly. And eventually the noise quiets down. You feel the grief and shame behind the pain. You accept. Don't have to blame anyone. Don't have to go over it anymore. And at some point, it's done. And the feeling of doneness is forgiveness. Forgiveness isn't so much something, but it's the lack of something, the resentment or the bitterness. And when you can forgive, the heart is relieved, and you can grow, and you are free. So in my mind, those, the karma and the forgiveness, before you launch into deep precept studies, probably the one to hold very, very closely. Because it's not easy. It's just not easy. So at this point, I'm just looking, okay, we've got lots of time. And as you know, I've been doing kind of a sense exercise, and I just realized with the Zendo, we've got a little bit of another variable. And so the invitation will be to get comfy and settle. And I don't know about the Zendo people, if they want to get an extra mat, or there are some extra cover-ups in the back in a basket or whatever way, or if you just want to keep that in mind for next time, you can. But for the rest of you that are familiar, you can participate. We know this is not traditional meditation technique, obviously, but it's been designed and offered as a different perspective for your practice. And I will guide you through some talk there. I will remind you that this is all optional. You may participate either fully or not at all, which means if you're on Zoom, you can turn me off the sound, or you can turn it off the screen if you're getting a little more comfortable. The ones in the Zendo, I guess you can just shut your eyes and turn me off that way. And that we're not going for any deep dives here in practice, but we're just trying to introduce and explore. But I really am asking you to be consciously as relaxed and as settled as you can be. If that includes your typical Zazen practice, that's fine. Just some position that can open you up and to go through this, to see, because we're looking at sense sensations. And if during this time you get started and you find it's not comfortable for you, again, it's your choice. So just if you have to get up and leave or just do something else, that's totally fine. So we're going to take a few minutes to settle. And I'm going to give you some suggestions or comments, and we're going to rest and reflect. So hopefully you found your position. Your eyes can be open or closed. You can be on a chair, on your back, on a bolster, on your side, whatever is the position that will give you permission to pick up the most comfortable position. And as you settle into your position and as your body begins to ease, you might choose to take a cleansing type breath, a deep breath in and out. And another deep breath in and out. And then if you choose, you can find a breath pattern that is calm and comfortable for you. And take a few moments and a few cycles of breath in your own way. And as you do that, you might invite yourself to consider the points of your body that are in contact with your cushion or your seat or your feet on the floor, your back against your chair, your hands in your lap or against the floor. And as you settle and soften into that gentleness of the earth and the pressures, can you ease a little bit more somewhere and accept the earth's support? And as you settle in ease, the invitation is to use maybe your breath to invite into your body, into your being, a sense of spaciousness, a sense of fearlessness, a sense of generosity, a sense of kindness and compassion. And as you breathe and settle, focus your attention on the goodness in your own heart. Feel its warmth in your chest and say to yourself, this is human goodness. Everyone has it just as I have it. And then if you like, consider one of the precepts that you find easy to sit with. Maybe one of the refuges, Buddha, or Dharma, or Sangha, or any other precept that has been mentioned. One that is natural or easy for you. The one that you know. KNOW. And when you reflect on that, where do you most feel its impulse? Maybe in the hands? Or in your heart? Your chest? Lower abdomen. And how does it feel? Warm? Tingling? Calm? Cool? And maybe you feel it in more than one place. Just think. And as we sit, the invitation is maybe to consider a precept or an incident that was just a tiny, tiny little bit sticky for you. Maybe something almost inconsequential to others, but noticeable to you. Maybe that snippy little unsolicited comment. Those glasses sure don't make your nose look any smaller. Or, you know what I heard? Gossip, gossip. Or maybe, it's okay, it doesn't matter. They have lots of those. A few more won't matter. Just go ahead. Or another one. Maybe just one. cookie, cigarette, few minutes of gaming. Now the invitation will be to continue in this reflection for just a little short time. And if you should feel uncomfortable, feel free to stop or go back to the first one. But we'll just take just a few moments. And when you considered that, if you chose to do this, where in your body did it perhaps reveal itself? Maybe as a slight flush in your cheeks, or a taste, a little fluttering or exhilaration, slight unsettling in your gut. Perhaps a slight contraction of your heart space. What, if anything, did you notice and feel? And can you just notice it? And just let yourself feel it? And take a breath and say to yourself, this is how it is. Can you just simply feel and accept the sensation? With no judgment, with no blame. And can you offer yourself the gift of forgiveness for simply being human? And so from Rumi, this being human is a guest host, every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty it of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Now the invitation will be to bring yourselves back to a more alert awareness. You may wish to begin by moving your hands and feet. Take some full breaths. A nice stretch. Nice yawn. And gradually in your own time, return to your seat, your Zoom, place in the Zendo, wherever that might be. Looks like everybody's. I'll give you a couple more minutes. Of course, you can stay pretty comfy too. You actually don't have to, I suppose. Yes. So to conclude, it's the same. You'll notice some repetition, which is intentional, by the way. You know, if you want to, consider what sensations stood out for you or not. Any that might have surprised you or made you curious. Any parts of your body that you didn't seem to feel anything or were neutral or unexplored. And how could you carry the awareness of these sensations to inform your day-to-day practice or living? Or in this case, the precepts. So a couple of exercises, things to think about or totally forget about. If you find yourself confronting a habit pattern that is maybe not so positive, can you instill a sense of coolness or calm into it? Or can you put on the no or the pause button and consider it? Or can you give the sensation a depth of color or a texture, something nonverbal? Or can you find a bodhisattva companion, like an animal or an entity? The one maybe perhaps represents forgiveness. And out of Norman's book, for a week, practice kind speech, saying to everyone you meet at some time that you appreciated them and why. Or whenever anything happens to you that you don't like, small or large, repeat the phrase, yes, this is how it is. And try and reflect on how it applies to the particular situation you're in. And if you do that or not, that's okay. I know what happens to my homework, and I might remember it just at the last time. So I thank you for joining me and continuing on this venture. And I think we'll close, and I'm not sure if anybody has to hop up to do Kokyo for the lead, but I'm going to mute. And I'll put my hands up, and then whenever you're ready, we can do the closing, and the announcements are back to Pat, or River, sorry.
Page number? Oh, page number 3 on your chant book, and I will share.